This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Reagan Gillum, a host on the channel, and today I'm talking to Dr. Elizabeth Horge Freeman, who is the author of the book Second Class Daughters, Black Brazilian Women and Informal Adoption as Modern Slavery, published by Cambridge University Press. I'm happy to welcome my fellow Cornelian, Dr. Horge Freeman, to the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk about your book. And I wanted to just start with a question we normally begin with about your background and how you came to the project. And so the book, you know, looks at the lives of informally adopted daughters in Brazil. And so I wondered how you came to write the book, and if you could just share with us about anything about, like I said, your background and what sparked your interest in the topic.
Sure. Well, in terms of what led me to write the book, the trajectory of writing this book is an interesting one because it started when I was collecting data for my first book, The Color of Love, Racial Feature Stigma and Socialization in Black Brazilian Families. And what I mean by that is while I was in Brazil, in Salvador, collecting data on Black families and looking at how families treat their children differently often, based on their racial features, I ended up meeting throughout my time women who were in these semi-slave situations. So because I was collecting data with Black families in working class neighborhoods, I actually lived in some of the most elite neighborhoods in El Salvador. So I would study one place, but go back to these other neighborhoods. And in these exclusive communities, I would constantly see women and start striking up conversations with these Black women who lived in these exclusive homes. And it was then that I discovered the first example of an informally adopted woman whose pseudonym is Nadia. When I saw Nadia sleeping on the floor of a teenage boy's bedroom, I thought, what in the world is this? Why is this woman on the floor? How is it possible that she's called a family member, yet she's not treated in that way? And so that first example really sparked my interest in continuing to collect narratives. And I should say that even after I met Nadia, I was still working on a different project. And so while I was in Brazil for a year working on The Color of Love, I continued to meet at least a dozen other women who were filhas de criação, informally adopted women who had lived or were currently still living in the homes of wealthier families that had adopted them, I'm using air quotes here, adopted them or taken them in under the guise of family, only to exploit them for free domestic labor. So that's the route of finding the women who are in this study. But my broader trajectory, which I think you're also asking about, is one that's rooted in sociology. So I'm actually a sociologist by training. So it's really great that I get to be on this podcast. And I'm a sociologist who looks a lot like an anthropologist. In fact, I was trained in part by Carol Stacks in terms of qualitative sociology, in terms of my qualitative work while I was at Duke University. And so in many ways, anthropological sensibilities can readily be seen in my approach to research and the types of questions that I ask and the focus that I tend to put on reflexivity. So the field of sociology brought me to these topics, my interest in understanding how systems of domination that include racism, sexism, classism, all collide to create these unique experiences for Black women really allowed me to come to this point to see these women who I was meeting in Salvador as worthy of being of understanding and understanding on their terms. So that I think that provides a general overview of the topic. Maybe the last thing I'll say is this. Whereas I had initially started with my first book, again, The Color of Love, focusing largely just on the realm of family, this book, The Second Class Daughters, also delves into dynamics, ways that families are can be situated to perpetuate inequality. But I think the difference about this book is also this important labor element. I've always been interested in labor exploitation. In fact, my interest in the transatlantic slave trade was connected to my interest in labor exploitation. So in many ways, Second Class Daughters represents the culmination of all of my academic and intellectual interests. And it allows me to really grapple with some of the, what Patricia Hill Collins calls this matrix of domination that Black women in particular find themselves in.
Yeah, thank you for that answer. And also speaking of, I guess, other qualitative anthropologists / sociologists, I learned about informally adopted daughters or criadas from France Windance Twine in her book, Racism and a Racial Democracy. And I wondered if that was the first time I encountered them, and then I kind of have not really seen them again, at least in English written, you know, research on race in Brazil. And I wondered, your book, of course, explores the lives of informally adopted daughters. And I wondered if you could tell us about criação or this informal adoption in Brazil, because I think it would be unfamiliar to many listening. And so how does one enter into this informal adoption? Why would parents give up their daughters to another family? And, you know, their lives really seem to be marked by like heavy labor for their adoptive families. What could you say, like, kind of generally about their lives as well?
Let me start by saying that France Windance Twine has always been a trailblazer and a model for me. And in fact, she was also, her book was the first time that I had read about criadas. And in fact, in her book, she has a picture of a young Black girl who's a criada. And literally that picture has always stayed with me. And even when I didn't realize it, I feel as though in some ways my research trajectory has been following that image of that young Black girl. Even when I think about The Color of Love, it was that image that drove my research. And Windance has just been such a fantastic mentor. And I know that that's less connected to this book, but I think it's so important to recognize the other women, the other Black women in the field who are helping bring others into this conversation. So her book was the first time that I learned about criadas and filhas de criação. For your listeners who may not be as familiar with the practice, criação is essentially a practice that exists all over Latin America, quite frankly, where poor families, often disproportionately indigenous and Black, will send their children to live in the homes of wealthier families, often with the promise of care. So because there's such a high level of precarity in Brazil and in other countries in Latin America, we see families really grappling to ensure their children's survival at any means necessary. And so what that ends up meaning is that when opportunities arise, when wealthy families sometimes approach socioeconomically disadvantaged or impoverished families, they're believing that these families actually have the well-being of their children in mind. And so they're willing to give them away because of the promise that their children's future might be assured, that their child might actually survive. And so in some cases, there's a question of having a better future. In other cases, families are giving their children, their daughters in particular, away because they fear that if they don't do that, they'll die of starvation. And we saw that with the example of Katia in Second Class Daughters. I should also mention, though, that Criação is absolutely connected to Brazil's history of slavery, of racialized chattel slavery. So the tradition of seeing Black women's bodies and Black girls' bodies as being exploitable, being disposable, those ideas certainly inform the cavalier way in which Black girls are often taken into families, exploited 24 hours a day in some cases for decades. We can only understand that by understanding how race, class, and gender and notions of bodies and values were crystallized during the transatlantic slave trade and continue even today in Brazil. So those are some of the connections. So in terms of motivating factors, what we found, poverty, certainly, starvation were huge. Marital dissolution and family strife, all of these factors would often lead to a young girl being sent to live in another family or being identified by a wealthier family as someone who they could help.
Yeah, and I was really struck by how their lives, once they got into these families, was very much about them working for the family and very little schooling that they were afforded.
No, that's exactly right. And what's interesting is that, and this is why it's so important to focus on the ways that the guise of family, the ideology of family, is really mobilized as a way to create distance or to really trivialize the exploitation that the young girls actually feel when they move into these families. So it absolutely is about labor. And what I refer to in the book is I talk about the reproduction, the social reproduction of inequality and the ways that Black girls in particular, their bodies are used to reproduce white and wealthier families. So they're considered expendable or they're considered ideally used when they can be used and exploited in a way that perpetuates white and wealthier families in Brazil.
Yeah. And I thought the book focused a lot about like affect, emotions, and feelings. And you have this concept of affective captivity, which you focus on in chapter 3, also kind of reverberates throughout the book. And you look at how feelings are central to the connection between these informally adopted daughters and their families, and many times in the face of significant abuse. And so you mentioned that sometimes people ask this question, like, why don't these women leave their families? So I assume like after they've sort of grown up, you found many of these adult women still attached to these families. And so this question might miss some complexity, but I thought your question of affective captivity helps to answer this, what keeps them connected. And so how does the affective terrain of emotion keep these women, you know, bound to the families that they were serving?
Well, that's a great question. And essentially, and perhaps even surprisingly, it ended up being, as you noted, the crux of the argument. So as a sociologist, folks are sometimes surprised that my research, both The Color of Love and The Second Class Daughters, focuses so much on emotions. But essentially, the argument I'm putting forth is that as social scientists, we need to be paying attention to what I call the affective architecture of domination. So emotions and affects aren't simply these emotional experiences, but rather they're connected to and can help reinforce the broader social structure. So for anybody interested in understanding inequality, we have to understand that affective architecture. So affective captivity in this book really helps to expose the ways that oppressors can manipulate people who are oppressed by isolating them from other networks, from convincing them that they are better off being exploited than exploring their own freedom. The other way that it works is that because these women end up raising, in some cases, 2, 3, and 4 generations of these wealthy and oftentimes white families, they develop affective ties to the children in the family. And because they are deprived of the opportunity to be mothers, because they typically don't have sexual relationships, romantic relationships, the way that motherhood is valued in Brazil and the way that these women in particular are deprived of any other sources of connection because of those things, filhas de criação end up developing these sincere affective ties with the people who they're taking care of. But that emerges, that's actually a symptom of the level of exploitation that they're experiencing. And so being able to bring to the fore how people can make decisions, as one of my respondents said, she wanted me to explain why she was, and I quote, making decisions against myself. If we understand the affective architecture of domination, we understand then how people who are oppressed can come to internalize their roles, internalize what's considered ideal, and act in ways that perpetuates the system even while they're hurt and even while they're disadvantaged. So this book, I would argue, was all about me grappling with that affective architecture, with thinking through affective captivity and understanding inequality, both as a function of some of the traditional social structural indicators, education, politics, economics. All of those aspects are important and are what sociologists tend to think about. I wanted to bring the affective realm to the table to be able to reveal how it actually works in tandem with the social structure to ensure or to help perpetuate structures of domination. Now, I say this, and I feel like I often should say that this is not totalitarian in the sense that I'm not suggesting that women are... That this affective captivity overdetermines how women act. I think that there's still space for agency, but that agency has to be understood within the context of this affective architecture. I hope that makes sense. You tell me whether or not that makes sense.
Well, that makes perfect sense. And from my reading of the book, I think that you summed it up very well. And you really did a beautiful job describing these emotions and these feelings in the book. And, you know, from the women's stories, these feelings kind of jumped off the page. So you did a great job describing that.
Good.
So gifting, reciprocity, and favors come up repeatedly across the different chapters. And as social scientists, we know that gifts are not simply the transfer of something from one person to the other, but, you know, they can tie people together by compelling like the return of the gift or reciprocity. And so this was an aspect of your argument that I really appreciated, particularly as an anthropologist, because we learn about the gift and we read most usually in our seminars, but I know that this goes, you know, beyond anthropology, and you really use these ideas of gifting really well in the book. And so I wondered how gifting and reciprocity play into criação or into this informal adoption.
So let me just say, this is another place where work of anthropologists was so important to the theorization of this. The gifting was everything. So often, once I developed rapport with my interviewees, they talked a lot about this notion of gratidão or gratitude. And that notion of gratitude is absolutely connected to the idea of gift and reciprocity and morality, really, for that matter. So part of the ideology was that these informally adopted women, criadas, should be grateful that these wealthier families had provided
a home and food for them. And as a result, they should be grateful for the gift that, that had been given to them. And for many of these, respondents, this idea of gift and debt, even more importantly, was what compelled them to stay in these situations, even when they could recognize they were being exploited, because they felt that they were morally obligated to return the gift, to engage in this reciprocity by providing this lifelong service. In fact, one of my respondents, Angela, I remember as we sat and we talked about her experience with the family, and she said, you know, I don't think I'll ever pay this debt back. And so she said that to say she would always be indebted to them. Whenever they call, she needs to be there because of the sense of debt and reciprocity that was so prevalent, both for her and I think in broader Brazilian society. Now, here's the rub, and I also write about this. In terms of reciprocity, what we know is that power shapes how people are held accountable for being reciprocal. So in the same ways that there's a notion of reciprocity, when you are a high status individual, you have much more latitude to not actually meet the requirements of reciprocity. Whereas if you're a low status individual and you depend on good relationships with higher status individuals to survive, then you're much more compelled to not want to break promises and to really ensure that you're acting in ways that are reciprocal, because your social standing as a lower status person, because your social standing as a lower status person depends on you having that type of moral credibility.
I was going to ask a question about your research methods or undertaking the research. And so you interviewed multiple women across a very long period of time through several follow-up interviews with these women. And I noticed in a footnote, you mentioned that many of the women reported that talking to you felt like therapy. And they told you kind of stories of abuse and neglect and, you know, something suffering that seemed to be, you know, quite disturbing. And I'll also note that I know that you did not, you know, represent yourself as a therapist, but, you know, that they knew that, you know, you would tell them you're doing sociological research and whatnot. But it seemed like the women, you know, really wanted to tell their stories to you. And I wondered, what was it like undertaking this research of eliciting these life stories of people whose personhood had, and lives really have just been denied and ignored for so long?
I appreciate that question, because as much as emotions are part of the theoretical underpinnings of this book, emotions had everything to do with the methodological process for me. It was incredibly difficult to hear these stories, to be collecting these stories, to be returning, because I think I felt torn. I felt torn in the sense that I knew that I was asking these women to talk about things that had been so traumatic that they had not yet spoken to anybody about it. For many of them, as I wrote in the book, they had not actually talked about their experiences at all. So their conversations with me were the first times that they had to really reflect on their experiences, moving away from the narrative of people treat me como si fosse filha da familia. So moving away from the idea that the families treat me as though I were a daughter, to me asking them to reconcile some of the contradictions that I was seeing and hearing. And what's important to remember is that I wasn't simply collecting life histories. I think what the contribution of this book is also is that I was also living with some of these families. So I saw this in action. I saw the allure and the seduction of being told that you're a family member and feeling in certain moments that you are in fact a member, but yet also then experiencing this differentiation within the family. And so it was very difficult. And I actually still struggle with that now, Reagan, because I still have a relationship with the women who I interviewed. So this is over a decade. Every time I went to Brazil, I would often interview these women. And so even now we have a relationship where they continue to engage with me over WhatsApp. And I mention WhatsApp because it's important it's an important it's an important app for women, for many of the women who can't read, because WhatsApp allows you to record your voice as opposed to having to send text messages. So these relationships are still ongoing, and I struggle with this. And I it was really important for me not to represent myself as a psychologist, especially because I could see and hear the level of trauma that they were experiencing. And in fact, per my IRB, my Institutional Review Board protocol, I actually had to provide them with information for therapists and psychologists. That was part of my plan to protect their well-being. And none of them took me up on that offer to use the resources that I provided. But in fact, as I wrote in the book, several of them had actually spoken to therapists. And that was actually the surprising part for me. Some of them had spoken to therapists, but those therapists weren't asking them the types of questions that would get them to be more critical about their situation. They were asking them questions that addressed some of the individual level issues rather than some of the structural issues of exploitation and racism and sexism.
Yeah, so you talked about earlier the idea of agency with these women and how your idea of affective captivity doesn't fully, you know, foreclose the agency that these women have over their lives. And so I wanted to ask you about chapter 7, because in it you discuss freedom and resistance with the informally adopted daughters or the criadas and who participated in your research. And I found these to be in some ways kind of very satisfying stories as I was reading the book of, you know, vindication and agency. And I wondered how you saw, if you could share with us a couple ways you saw these women taking back control over their lives, which you provide at the end of the book.
Yeah. So let me first say, I really struggled with this book. This book has taken me years to write because I wanted to write it in a way that felt authentic to women's experiences. And what they would say is that at the same time that they understood, most of them understood that they had been victimized, they also wanted to highlight and to acknowledge ways that they were pushing back. They didn't want to be seen as purely victims, and they're not that. And so chapter 7 for me was a way for me to make sure that the reader was left with a much more holistic understanding of these women as warriors, not as passive victims. And so when you ask the question about how women were resisting and what are some of the examples, I want to start off by saying that the chapter is structured in a very particular way. I knew that by the time the reader had gotten to had reached chapter 7, they had seen a lot, they had read a lot. It's traumatic, I think, reading the book. And so for me, it was important to give the reader that gratifying or satisfying end to know that there was more beyond the trauma. And I start off chapter 7 talking about the examples of two women who literally escaped. So these are women who were able to connect themselves with different networks, who used education and the resources that they had available to not just escape their families, but to escape their families, find success later in life, and then go back to those families that had exploited them to show them that they had actually made it. That was, for me, Regan, the stories of Katya and Gianna were really gratifying and satisfying to see, to be able to tell, and for me to be able to learn. But that's not the most common trajectory. It's one trajectory, but that's not the most common. And in fact, I think the most realistic and most prevalent outcome was one where women figured out how to navigate I think the most compelling examples of resistance are the examples of how women had to navigate both coexisting in a situation where they were both being exploited, but trying to carve out spaces and degrees of freedom, as I've have said. So other examples. So you have examples of the women who literally ran away, but then you also have examples of women who decide to move out from their families, but still connect but are still connected to the informally adoptive family. So Angela, for example, is able to move out of the family home, but she's still bound to them. I mentioned her before. She feels eternally indebted to them. But a way that she figures out how to navigate that is that she decides to just spend less time in the family, because she knows that the more that she's around, the more they're going to be likely to call her to clean and do household labor. At the same time, she strategically makes decisions about when she engages with them in order to be able to do the things with them that she wants on her terms. So she'll spend time with them during Carnival for a couple of days that they spend together, but then she spends time separately with a group of friends that she has apart from this family. She provides assistance when family members get sick, but she also works to try to figure out how to create boundaries so that she doesn't feel as exploited. In other cases, you have women who have not yet left these homes. These are women who are, as of June 2022, still in these homes, and they have to figure out strategies that don't allow them to leave physically, but that allow them to navigate the situation that they're in. So in one case, you have women who talk about through the course of our interview how they learn how to develop their voice. So over the 10 years that we are speaking in the interviews, when we have these recurring meetings or follow-up interviews, they talk about how they find their voice, how they start to say, no, this is actually something that happened to me, or no, I won't provide this labor without you providing compensation. So these are seemingly small steps, but for these women who had never, who had for a long time, for decades, not been able to advocate for themselves in explicit ways, what are seemingly these small gestures end up really being meaningful to them. They also try to manipulate the same language of family to get the things that they want. So this is another example of resistance. Again, for the majority of filhos de criação, they don't just run away. So they have to figure out how to best situate themselves given the situation. Nadia, for example, talks about how she manipulates this language of family to convince one of her informally adopted family members to buy her this elaborate and fancy dress and heels and jewelry. And she uses the excuse that she's the one that is called, that is described as being like a mother. And she uses that to say, if I'm like a mother to you, then you should actually buy me these things. And she's successful at getting her family member to do that. But these are just small examples of how in the day-to-day world, these women try to resist. They also resist by reconceptualizing their experiences, by reframing their experiences. So this moral piece is such a critical piece to this book, because we find that women reframe their long suffering, well, reframe their exploitation as long suffering and as moral fortitude and their ability to stay in these exploitative situations as evidence of their moral righteousness. And I'm really cautious about this because on one hand, this can lead to devastating outcomes, but what I wanted to do was to be able to capture how the women themselves articulated their resistance. And that was one way that they did so, is by working really, really hard to retain as much as they could of their, what was considered their moral fortitude.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really enjoyed reading this chapter as well, and these stories. And I really liked the first stories that you mentioned of them going back to the families and showing them as successful. That was amazing.
Yeah, no, it was really great to have had those stories. I needed those stories, Regan, in the field, because it was difficult to hear so much trauma. But I think at the same time, and this is what Katya says, Katya, who's able who runs away and then later confronts the family. She says that people will say that she shouldn't be upset, that she should express gratitude because look, she made it out. And what Katya also always says, and Katya is the sole white criada in this book, I should mention. But she says it wasn't worth it. She says, I would have traded anything. I would have traded to be able to live with my family, to not have been abused, even if it meant not having achieved the things that I achieved, because I lost something really important, which is the connection to family and to childhood and this innocence that she wants not to be overshadowed by people focusing on the successes that she's had, if that makes sense.
And in the beginning of your last answer, you were talking about wanting to write the book in a way that felt authentic to the women's lives. And I wanted to ask you about writing, because you present these really rich stories and they really convey the details of people's lives. And you really render these scenes with great care of you, like sitting down and interviewing people or talking with people. And so I noticed two things in your writing. There's probably more I could say, but I won't say too much, but I really like reading your work. And I've of course read The Color of Love and this book. And so I wondered, you use a lot of different references, of course, to emotion when describing these encounters, both your emotions and their emotions. And so, for example, you were talking to a woman, Hebecca, about her childhood, and you asked her about her childhood. And I think she said that she didn't have a childhood. And you write, her response left you feeling embarrassed that I had even asked the question. And so you're constantly referring to, you know, your emotions throughout the text, which I think links up with your idea of affect. And then also, I noticed in the book, you have these very clever titles for these different sections. And for example, when you talk about health issues associated with these informally adopted daughters, you write that they lack sleep. And so you call the chapter Sleepless in Salvador as just one example. And so I wanted to ask you about your writing practices, if you have any like tips or routines that you follow when conveying these rich stories about people's lived realities.
Well, you know what? Thank you so much for saying that, because, you know, I think that and this might be uncommon, I think that the style is just as important as the substance, and that the style can help highlight the substance of what we write about. So I take great care in the way that I write. So it's always gratifying when people notice the titles and notice the ways that I talk about emotions, because it's intentional. And the reason for that is, if I'm completely honest, as a sociologist, I am also hugely impacted by writers who are amazing. And I've written about this before. I've always imagined wanting to bring the sensibility and the wordsmithing of Toni Morrison to sociology, right? I do not claim to be able to do that, but that's always what's in my mind. I grew up reading Toni Morrison's novels and being completely captivated by her characters. And what I wanted to bring to real research was some of that same sensibility that really helped to capture the human experience. And to do that as a sociologist, I am convinced that I can't do that well if I'm pretending that my emotions and my experiences aren't part of this. And I think that qualitative researchers too often don't situate themselves in the work. And I think that this is a delicate navigation, where we don't want to talk too much about ourselves in the book, but it is important for the audience to understand how the author is feeling, because that shapes their understandings of the relationships, of the ways that the researcher is processing the information. A few years ago, I wrote an article called Bringing Your Whole Self to Research. And I wrote that because I wanted to capture the fact that my emotions, in addition to emotions being the topic of research, it's valuable. It helps us. If we're more in touch with our emotions, then we're able to do a better job at monitoring ourselves, when sometimes the emotions can have the impact of inhibiting us from seeing what people are actually saying and experiencing. And let me give you an example of this. And this is a learning process. Initially, as I was meeting Filha Chiquiressel, I felt extremely angry. The best word I can use is just anger at the level of exploitation. And I really had to temper that anger to understand the motivations that the women had for themselves and the understandings that the women gave to their situation. So if I had let the anger lead the work, I wouldn't have been able to look at the nuances of ways that they resisted. I wouldn't have been able to understand the affective captivity because I would have been inclined to frame, to dismiss those relationships that these women have with their family members. But we can only have those sensibilities when we're honest with ourselves as researchers about what we are also experiencing emotionally, confronting that, monitoring that, and then being honest with the audience about what those negotiations look like. So I try to write Reagan the book that I want to read. You know, mm-hmm. I think about all the great things that I love about books. They're books that are emotionally captivating, but that don't leave you drained, but that also allow you to feel as though you're there and you understand complex individuals. And the creative subtitles and subsections for me is as much about me and keeping me engaged and excited and challenged to think more creatively about the audience as it is about making sure that the audience is stays engaged with the work and invests in the real lives of the women who have spent 10 years of their life speaking to me. So that I really appreciate you pointing that out and seeing that, because it's a huge part of my writing process, is really thinking through how I can best capture the totality of individuals. And let me say this, if I can, Reagan, mm-hmm. that was particularly challenging for Second Class Daughters. The reason why it took so long for me to finish this book is because I also felt like I needed to protect the identities of the women in the book. So I couldn't actually be as descriptive and share all of what I wanted to share with the audience about these incredible women. And mm-hmm. so when I read this book, part of me that doesn't like to return to the book, because I was not able to completely share with the audience the fullness of these women, because I was afraid. I wanted to make sure that I could protect their identities and not give anything away. And so that took longer to tell the story in a way that was more measured, so that I could protect them in that way.
Yeah, that's so important in thinking about, you're right, disclosing identity and thick description. Those right. are things that, yeah, we have to balance. That's really interesting. So I wanted to end, I guess, with this question about your work in general. As I said before, I've read your book, The Color of Love. I've also taught it twice in my classes. And then, of course, I've just read your book, Second Class Daughters. And your work can be kind of activating in a way, because you focus on the family as a site of inequality, oppression, but also resistance. And love, as you know, in The Color of Love. And this disrupts many commonly held ideas about the family, which might be that the family is only a space of refuge and acceptance. And so, as I said, I've taught your book, and the students have noticed this in a way when they've engaged with your work as well. And so I wondered, what does this work on racial dynamics and inequality in families in Brazil mean to you? And is there something particularly important to you about this topic?
That is a good question. And when I give talks about this, people ask me, why is it that you are so interested in families and so invested in showing the good and the bad and the ways that they can resist and reproduce, which is in some ways transgressive, as you mentioned, in terms of how we typically see families. And I think that my investment in this topic emerges in part from my relationships in my own families, in my own family, and seeing just how vital my family upbringing has been to who I am. I'm one of six children. My mom had 11 siblings. We all grew up in the same place on the same street. And in fact, I now live in Tampa again, where all of my family, four generations of my family has lived. And I say that to say, at the same time that I recognize how powerfully motivating and inspirational families can be, I also saw ways that families could be damaging. And I've always been interested in kind of pulling the curtains back on these these notions of what these ideal institutions are like, because I've seen that people and institutions are just much more complex than we ever give them credit for being. And family is so powerful in terms of mobilization, in terms of organization against systems of domination. But I also wanted to show how these same institutions, much like anything else, when they are can be perverted in a way that allows them to do quite the opposite. And some folks would even argue, and this is this will be a separate conversation, that the family of the structure of family by definition, at least in our contemporary society, tends to be very patriarchal, tends to be rooted in hierarchy and power and inequality. And so I've always been interested in unpacking and disentangling the ways that not just families, but institutions that people are emotionally attached to can have a role of both supporting them and undermining them as well. And I think about this. So when I think about family, I also think about nation. I think about the position, particularly of African descendants in Latin America, who are often socialized to believe that they're part of the national family, although that their membership in the national family is often predicated on them being subjugated. It's predicated on them recognizing that they're part of the nation as long as they play a certain role, as long as they understand that they're not going to be elevated to certain positions. And so those contradictions are fascinating to me. And I think the more that we understand them, the more we can leverage institutions in ways that will allow us to reach our goal. And if our goal is more equity, more inclusion, the dismantling of structures of oppression, we have to understand how all of these institutions work and in multidimensional ways.
Yeah, thank you for that. That is so, so important. And so we always like to end with this question of what you're working on next, or if you have any upcoming projects that you're thinking about beginning. So what's on the horizon for you, either with work or with research?
Yes. So I am working on a theoretical book now. So I've written quite a bit about emotions. I'm working on a standalone manuscript that deals with these questions of what I call in Color of Love, affective capital, affective captivity, and this notion of the affective architecture of domination. So I really want to grapple with what is the theoretical contribution that I'm making to the field that will allow other researchers to use similar apparatus in their research. So that's one piece. I'm also interested in returning to Brazil. I imagine myself being able to testify in Congress about research in my book and make recommendations for how the government can develop better policies to be able to create some oversight. And again, this is not just relevant for Brazil, but it's really a problem across the diaspora. Also in parts of Africa, we see these practices where young girls often are taken and exploited under the guise of family. So I'd like to translate the theoretical and conceptual to some concrete legislative and policy change. And then lastly, and I mentioned this, I'm not sure if I mentioned this in the span of this podcast, but I've moved into administration. And Reagan, you and I talked about the fact that I'm in this interim vice president role, mm-hmm. Where I'm leading the DEI efforts at my university. And for me, that's been an incredible experience of, again, translating what I've learned from a theoretical perspective about race, class, gender, the intersectionality of identities, the ways that systems of oppression work. I'm now able to be in a role where I can make recommendations connected to policies and development and training that allow us to transform institutions. So I feel like I'm in a really great place to continue to do this work, to continue learning and continue to center the human experience as the human experience and the experiences of underrepresented groups, particularly Black women, as a guidepost moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for that. That's so important, putting research into practice in such productive ways, like actually trying to transform our social situations, which is usually the reason why so many of us go into research in the first place.
Right.
So thank you so much, Elizabeth. I have been speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Horch Freeman, the author of Second Class Daughters, Black Brazilian Women and Informal Adoption as Modern Slavery, published by Cambridge University Press. Thank you so much for writing this book, Elizabeth, and thank you for sharing it with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Reagan. And I just have to also thank you for always, for years, being supportive of my research. It's been great to be a collaborator with you and to work alongside of you during pretty much this entire time. So it's been a pleasure to be part of this podcast.
Thank you.